history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are heroes around you, seemingly ordinary Americans who really have done extraordinary things on our behalf. We want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we will never forget the price that has been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we end up learning so much. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. From my personal perspective, they've been inspiring me for a long time, even before a desire to record my grandfather's World War II story led to my starting to interview veterans on television. A couple years later, we started this radio program to add to that effort, and I bring that up because this weekend holds significance. It was 10 years ago, October 7th, 2007, that the very first episode of Hometown Heroes aired on KMJ Radio in Fresno, California. It is still airing on those same airwaves, as well as quite a few other stations now, like the one you're listening to right at this moment. 10 years is a long time in the radio business, and I think it would take me at least another decade to share just how giant a blessing this has been in my life to spend time with so many amazing Americans all across this country. They've represented incredible diversity, but reflected a unity of purpose and commitment to the ideals of America, even when those ideals weren't always carried out perfectly. I've sat down with veterans in luxurious estates, as well as trailer parks, and everything in between. Sometimes we've been on hallowed ground, like the USS Arizona Memorial at Pearl Harbor, or the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., in state veterans' homes in places like Ogden, Utah, or Truth or Consequence, New Mexico. Other times in settings as unique as San Francisco's Fisherman's Wharf, the VA hospital in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, or a bench outside a Walmart in Mesa, Arizona, where ex-prisoners of war were handing out daisies for remembrance. The veterans themselves represent such a vast array of cultural backgrounds: Native American, African American, Latino, Filipino, Chinese American, Japanese American. That list goes on and on and on. And every corner of the political spectrum has been represented here. There's religious diversity as well: Buddhist, Jewish, Mormon, Catholic, Protestant, even a few who don't profess a faith. As different as these hundreds of veterans have been, and as unique as their individual experiences happen to be, one thing they all share, one common bond that we've seen and heard without exception, is their commitment to put the cause of our country before their own personal feelings. It has been powerful to hear that over and over again. The memory of a far from perfect, but yet united America that coalesced behind freedom and liberty and opposed tyranny around the globe. I don't think I need to point out to you how relevant that seems to be in the times we're living in now. The stories were relevant 10 years ago when we launched Hometown Heroes. Yes, they are relevant today, and I believe they'll remain relevant long into the future. We've heard this often, but it's true. Those who fail to learn from history are destined to repeat it. So let's not be those people who fail to learn from our history. I know I don't usually ramble on this long, and I'll wrap it up now because this show is not about me. It's about our veterans and the things that they endured. And I think you'll enjoy the perspective we pick up today from one ex-prisoner of war, his wife, who was pregnant with their first child when she heard that he was missing in action. And then, before our time runs out today, a little excerpt from that very first episode of Hometown Heroes that aired 10 years ago this weekend. That's what we have to look forward to, and we begin with 94-year-old Ed Crominga of Hollister, California, who nearly pulled it off. He was close to completing all 35 of his scheduled missions as a ball turret gunner in B-24 Liberators with the 454th Bomb Group, flying out of Italy. But Ed's 33rd mission in November of 1944 would become his last. He'd have to endure the rest of World War II as a prisoner in Germany. But before we get to all that, Ed, I want to hear about Anamosa, Iowa. I know your hometown is between Cedar Rapids and Dubuque, And today it's home to the National Motorcycle Museum. But I want to know, what was it like growing up in Anamosa in the 1930s?
I was still on the farm.
Uh-huh.
Born and raised there, of course.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
Yes, I have two sisters, or had two sisters, and how many brothers? Three?
Two sisters, three brothers.
Mm-hmm.
I bet you had a lot of chores, too.
A lot of chores. Milked usually in the neighborhood of 21 head of cattle by hand. And just about the time I left, they got a machine in there to help milk the cows and stuff instead of doing it by hand.
Came a little too late for you, huh?
Yes. Yeah.
So you milked all those cows yourself every day?
No. It was most of the time my dad and one of my brothers part-time, you know.
Yeah.
They were in and out, of course.
How early in the morning did you have to get up to go milk those cows?
Every morning. I don't know what time it was, but in the neighborhood between 5 o'clock to 6, any time in there.
I know it's a long time ago, but do you remember as a boy, do you remember having those dreams, hey, when I grow up, here's what I'm going to do, here's what I'm going to be?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure of that. Hoping to fly someplace more than anything else, I think.
Where did that come from? Where did that desire to fly come from?
I don't know. I think it was just because there was a very few planes. I know if one would fly over, you'd stop everything to watch it go. It was just something to see.
I think what I'm trying to figure out, it's how a guy as tall as you are, you're almost 6 feet tall. How did you end up in the ball turret on a B-24?
I do not know, because normally you'd have to wear your uniform for if you got hit, you could drop from the turret. I couldn't do that. I had to go back up and get mine.
In other words, it was so cramped in the ball turret of a B-24 mm-hmm. that you couldn't have a parachute with you.
That's right.
Could you even fire those guns? I mean, you must not have had much elbow room either.
Oh, yeah. No, I could move all the way around, up and down, so that I could catch the person I was supposed to try to bomb on.
And one of the main purposes of that ball turret is that you would see enemy fighters coming, if they're
yes.
coming from beneath the airplane or from the side.
Yes.
What does that feel like when you're down there and all that's separating you from those other planes is a little sheet of plexiglass,
mm-hmm.
and you know they're trying to kill you. What does that feel like in those moments?
The first thing you did is want to know where and when those planes were coming. And usually the people on top would see the enemies, I'll put it that way. I do know that every time we found out that there was a few holes that wasn't there before after we got there and back, but almost always got a few little holes or something in place. Of course, they had everything checked as soon as we got back. So,
how close were those holes to your position?
One was just over my head because I was on a ball turret underneath the plane. And in order to get information and stuff from them, I would have to crank it out and get up into their plane. Because I was sitting below. Sometimes they would help me a little bit, but then most of the time they would be looking out the windows and seeing what's going on too.
How often in those 33 missions did you actually use those machine guns that you had in the ball turret?
Well, we used them every time we went out, but most of the time it was just to make sure that it was in action and not damaged somehow.
You had to fire a burst to make sure it's operational.
That's right.
What about actually seeing fighters coming toward you?
Then you would locate them and made sure that if you had to and could shoot, have to be prepared for it.
How hard was that? Because I imagine they're moving pretty fast.
It might be fast, but we were fast and they were fast, so it's just a matter of locating them and operating your turret to that direction.
Were there times where the rounds you fired hit the enemy planes?
I'm sure, but you never knew until you got shot down. But I don't think we thought of it. We just flew, came back, got out, and of course we had to make sure our turret was up and out of the way for landing.
Dorothy's got a photo there of your crew. What can you tell me about the guys that you flew with? What were they like?
Just almost like your brothers, I guess. You became close to every one of them because you had to depend on them.
And I guess I need to explain here that all of these missions you're flying with the 454th Bomb Group, you're a married man. You and Dorothy got married 2 days after D-Day. You're carrying a picture of her in your pocket on all these missions. And then you find out while you're overseas that she is expecting your first child. What was it like to receive that news?
I think it was really something. I don't know how to explain it, but it was great to know.
Well, what happened on that 33rd mission? What do you remember? What can you tell me about that?
When we got hit?
Yeah.
I think everything was going on pretty pleasant for a while, other than the fact it was getting to be, I'm not sure how to say this, but it seemed like we flew almost right into where we're going to bomb. Of course, we had to drop the bombs.
Right.
And almost always, they would pull away from the rest of the crew and take off and locate them after they were clear. And I don't know whether the other planes did that or all that they all stayed together, but our plane always took off after bombs were dropped.
So once you drop your bomb and you peel off and you're going to return, you'd separate from the formation until they had all dropped their bombs, and then you'd form up again.
Yes.
But this time?
Well, we got hit. It was terrible. I know we got hit, and I knew I had to get out because in my turret, I couldn't get in my parachute. So I knew I had to get out and put it on, and I did that. Got my suit on and looked out the window and saw it was going down pretty fast, so I bailed out. Made one swing, swung back, and hit the bank of a river.
Because you were so low.
Yes.
Your parachute only swung out one side of the pendulum. You never went back the other way because you were so low.
Yes. You went back, but that's when we hit the bank of a creek out there that was not. There was no water in it that time. It was dry.
Uh-huh. But that impact must have been pretty strong.
It hit, but it was just happy to be down. And
were you injured?
No, I really wasn't. But the thing is, when we hit and I opened my eyes and there was two guns just a few inches from my head and two young people, very young people, holding them.
Like teenagers?
Yeah, I would say so. They were actually kids, I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
They just stood there and held the guns in my face until another guy came along and he acted like our friend.
Were you knocked unconscious when you hit?
No, sat there real still.
So of the 11 men on your crew, 5 of them died. How close do you think you were to not making it out of that?
Pretty close, pretty close.
There are guys who bailed out at that low altitude who were killed by the impact with the ground.
That's
true. 500 feet is awfully low.
My whole back was leveled with the where I came down and hit. Mm. Opened my eyes and two rifles were in my face.
Yeah. Did they say anything to you?
No. I don't know because I didn't understand them until one guy that could speak my language.
What does it feel like to be half a world away from your pregnant wife and now realize you're going to be a prisoner for who knows how long?
You know, I can't really tell you. It's.
Were you afraid?
I don't think I had time for that.
I guess what I'm interested in understanding is what got you through all that? Because you're shot down in November of 1944. Mm-hmm. You're not going to be, you don't know this, but you're not going to be liberated till the end of April in 1945. So that's a good 5 months that you were a prisoner of war. What was the hardest part of that? What was the most challenging thing to endure?
It just, nothing seemed to bother me. I knew they had to take care of me somehow or other. I just didn't seem to have any fears, bad fears.
And at age 94, Ed's memory isn't quite what it used to be. You're hearing him share today those things that are still pretty clear when he taps into the memory banks. But about 20 years ago, when even more details were readily accessible for him, he sat down and started typing out some of his experiences. What a treasure that account is for his family today. And with the Krominga's permission, I'm going to read some of that to you to help add to what we heard from Ed today, and then we'll get back to some of his thoughts here in 2017. He writes, "One day, what we considered as our buddy crew was shot down over Yugoslavia. We got word that they were captured by the group who would sell them to the highest bidder, so the U.S. eventually got them back and returned them to our base. By the time they got back, they were supposed to fly on a mission right away, but one of the men had a broken leg, so he couldn't go. The rest of them were still kind of in shock from being captured by kind of an enemy, a mercenary that would go either way for money, and they refused to fly. So we took their place for the rest of their recuperation days, and we went in their place on their mission. We had a new B-24 called Good Heavens, and we were getting used to it. Everybody had put their wives' or girlfriends' names by the positions that they flew in. We all had good, confident feelings again, and a real good feeling for the ship. We got to our plane that morning. Each of us checked out our positions and put our gear in the proper place. I put my parachute where I could find it in case of emergency. My position was ball or belly turret with twin 50s automatic machine guns with a large tray of rounds for each of the guns. It also had the latest sights to use. If you could frame the target, it would allow you for lead and distance. If I could have worn the backpack in the turret, I'd be able to open the door from below the waist and drop out that way. However, that was another story because I couldn't do it. The only thing for me was, if we lost power, I had to rely on the waist gunner to manually crank me up to get out. That man was Pete Merle. After coming out of the clouds, the squad was nowhere in sight, so there was nothing to do but stay on course to the target. We couldn't use the radio because we were in radio silence in enemy territory. As we were nearing the target, the pilot spotted another squad about ready to make their bomb run, so he sped up a great deal to catch them and drop our bombs in their pattern. It felt good to be rid of the bombs and be in the company of other planes. As we were heading home, the pilot, or navigator, saw our squad again quite a ways ahead and low. So in order to go home with our own squad, we started to drop and speed up to catch them. This must have been a day of bad decisions because they went into another cloud bank and that was the last we saw of them. At that time, the navigator told the pilot of a mobile 3-gun anti-aircraft unit ahead. The pilot didn't waste time to swing away from those guns. The navigator laughed at the sudden move and gave the pilot new coordinates to get back on track again toward home. Just as the new heading was made, the tail gunner and I saw anti-aircraft puffs right behind us at our exact altitude. We called on the intercom at the same time. There was no time to do anything. There were 3 puffs behind us, and we felt the 4th hit us. It was a hard jolt and kind of a quiet sensation. Then for me, I kind of panicked. Did I lose all power? I hit my controls hard to get the turret up so I could get out. It seemed that it wasn't going to move, but in reality, I suppose it reacted at a normal rate. As I opened the door, the crew was looking out of the waist windows. When Pete saw me, he said, "My God, I forgot you might need help." I went to the window also. We could see the landing strip below that we seemed to be circling. We had done this before, but not quite as tight a circle. I asked one of the crew if anyone had checked forward. He said no. When I opened the bay doors and looked forward, I could see a large hole where the nose wheel had been, and the pilot and co-pilot, and just above that with nothing to protect them. I told the crew of what happened, and we were starting to spin faster and tighter. The wind took me right out. I felt my chute pop, jerking me around in a swing. Saw the plane crash just ahead of me, with the engines being the largest things I could see. I started to swing back and found myself hitting the side of the ditch. This all happened so fast I didn't realize much until I felt myself being dragged by my chute. Ed goes on to describe his time in captivity, from his interrogation to the 3 different German prison camps he ended up in, even meeting a young man from his hometown of Anamosa, Iowa, at one of them. He also describes his liberation from Stalag 7A in Moosburg, Germany, where he was for roughly 2 weeks until General Patton and his forces came to liberate them. Of coming home, he says, "One night, coming in late, we could actually see the Statue of Liberty, really quite a sight to us all." And after coming ashore in New York, he took a train to St. Louis, and from there would head back to his native Iowa. And I think you should hear that in Ed's voice, not mine.
Oh, I couldn't wait to see the farm again. Weren't actually prisoners anymore, but they treated us like as if we're kings and queens or something like that for a while.
What did it feel like to stand next to that crib and see your baby daughter for the first time?
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. It was something else. I don't know what I'd do without them. That's for sure, all of them down.
And Dorothy says she wins all your arguments. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. She knows how to talk.
Well, we're going to hear her talk in just a minute. It's time for a break. But when we come back, a perspective we probably don't get enough on this show, that of a young wife who knows her husband is flying dangerous missions, then finds out he's missing, then that he's a prisoner, and finally has her dream come true when he shows up back in Iowa. But wait until you hear what exactly that sight he saw was when he tapped on her bedroom window in the middle of the night on what just happened to be their first anniversary. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.